From NPR News, you're listening to Weekends on All Things Considered, a podcast that gathers the weekend's very best stories and features from All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz, the host of the program. This week, what happens when the president loses grip of his own narrative? Also, the lost libraries of famous novelists and the things they wrote in the margins of their rivals' books. Plus, how musician Michael Franti learned to find joy in the darkest places on Earth, and the courage of Ingrid Betancourt. For 6 years, she was tortured and held captive by the Colombian rebel group FARC. That's on this edition of Weekends on All Things Considered. A lot of Democrats, including people in the White House, have been scratching their heads lately, wondering how President Obama has managed to allow others to define his narrative. How, they ask, did the terms stimulus and health care and even hope become toxic in the minds of many voters? That's basically the question Velma Hart put to the president at an open town hall forum this past week.
I'm exhausted of defending you, defending your administration, defending the mantle of change that I voted for.
One of the challenges of a modern presidency is competing with all the other information out there and trying to cut through it. But the minute you start to lose control of the narrative, well, that's when the trouble starts. And for one ex-president, Jimmy Carter, it happened on a spring afternoon in 1979. He was on a solo fishing trip in White Plains, Georgia, when a rabbit helped to unravel his presidency. Princeton historian Julian Zelizer picks the story up from here.
His press secretary, Jody Powell, in August of 1979, tells Associated Press reporter Brooks Jackson about this story. And he tells Jackson that Carter had been on a fishing trip and he had been in a canoe in April when this kind of large hissing swamp rabbit had tried to make his way onto Carter's boat, and Carter had kind of used his paddle to bat away at this rabbit. And the story amused Jackson, and Jackson wrote kind of a small humorous piece which he thought would be relatively innocuous, and he sends it out on the wire, and he doesn't actually think much of it.
Jimmy Carter, who promised always to tell the truth, reports the existence of a presidential attack rabbit somewhere in Georgia. Susan Spencer reports from Watership Down.
Mr. Carter's story apparently goes something like this.
And the Washington Post publishes the story on August 30th on the front page. And the title was Bunny Goes Bugs, Rabbit Attacks President.
The president wasn't hurt, but he was annoyed when he learned that none of his aides believed him. Luckily for him, one of the ever-present White House photographers...
And the networks and other papers quickly pick up on the story, and there's all these reports on this killer rabbit that attacked the president, and Carter was trying to, you know, beat him away. And it became yet another symbol of a kind of failed presidency.
But the White House has refused to release the picture. His assistant claimed that the president didn't want to reveal the site of his favorite fishing hole. Asked later if this picture made Mr. Carter look a bit foolish, he repeated what he'd said about the fishing hole.
A White House photographer, Kansas Republican Bob Dole, who was planning to run for president in 1980, he makes a joke and he says Carter should apologize for bashing the bunny on the head with a paddle. And Dole says, in fact, the poor thing was simply doing something a little unusual these days, trying to get aboard the president's boat. Everyone else seems to be jumping ship. It was a way for people to talk not just about this odd incident, but about the fact that this was a president who seemed weak, seemed isolated, literally on a boat without any friends or allies.
That's historian Julian Zelizer, author of the book Jimmy Carter. Now, you may have noticed a lot of comparisons being drawn lately between the beleaguered presidency of Jimmy Carter to that of President Obama's. In the latest issue of The New Yorker, for example, Jimmy Carter's vice president, Walter Mondale, implied that President Obama, like Carter, may be losing confidence in his ability to move public opinion. So I asked Julian Zelizer whether he thinks the Obama administration has also lost the ability to frame its message.
I think haven't lost it yet, but they have relinquished it to others. It's been one of the more striking parts of his presidency. Republicans from the town hall meetings through the midterm campaigns have been able to shape this story about a quote-unquote big government liberal quasi-socialist in the White House, which is at odds with a kind of rather centrist Clintonian Democrat who's very much a believer in a kind of market government partnership.
These are frustrating times inside the White House, according to New York Times political columnist Matt Bai. It's not that they don't believe in what they're doing. They're just not sure how to explain it.
They see the narrative they're trying to put out there as really reaching back to 2009, right? That they came in, that they had this disaster to deal with. It was not of their making. They've kept it from getting all that much worse, which is probably true. It's arguably true. And that there's only so much they can do to turn it around on the electoral time frame. And I think there's been a sense in the White House that they were almost victimized by this, handed this mess, and a sluggishness to come to terms with the fact that the American public doesn't really care anymore how they came to inherit this. The American public seems to be primarily focused on what's going to happen next.
It's always easy to point out communications, right? To say we're not communicating all the great things we've done really well as we should be doing.
Right. There's no one in politics who doesn't say that when things are bad.
It's almost like a backhanded compliment to yourself.
It is.
But was there a point in the last few months where they really did make mistakes by not allowing their story to be told in the way that maybe they thought it should be told?
I think the sense in the White House is that they have tried to communicate their successes but have had a very difficult time getting them across to people in a difficult environment. The media hasn't been helpful. The conditions haven't been helpful. I mean, I have written that a lot of this goes back to the first few months of the administration and the expectations they set and the way they set up the programs they were undertaking. You know, you remember they had this moment where the approval ratings were extraordinarily high. There was a pervasive acknowledgement of the crisis. People wanted some direction. And they had a moment, I think, to lay out a series of challenges and how they would be addressed. And what they really did was focus on that stimulus bill. And had the economy turned around to the extent that they told people they thought it would, we would not be having this conversation about killer rabbits and whatever else. We would be having a very different conversation. But it didn't. And that moment was lost to differentiate for people the different aspects of the problem that we faced. But I don't get a sense from the White House that there's a sense of, wait a minute, we had the wrong policies here. We better check ourselves now, have a big long moment of introspection because the economy is not doing what we said it would. I think the sense is, would have been nice if we could have spent even more money, but things are going to go in the right direction. It's just taking longer than we'd hoped, and unfortunately it's not on the most optimistic electoral timetable, but we're still headed in the right direction. I don't have a sense that there is a core questioning of their economic policy at this point.
That's Matt Bye. He's the national political columnist for the New York Times. Matt Bye, thanks so much for coming in.
Anytime, Guy. Thank you.
So what to do? Well, presidential historian Robert Dalek says it's worth taking a look at what others did. He says ask Americans which presidents they consider the greatest.
They consistently tell you Washington, Lincoln, FDR. But then they'll add the names of John Kennedy and Ronald Reagan. Now, why? Because those are the two recent presidents who I think give people hope. They remember certain things they said. So it's optimism, hope. And that, of course, was very much President Obama's message in the campaign, hope. But hope is sort of diminished now. It's faded. And as a consequence, somehow he needs to reestablish that sense of possibility, of a vision, of a better day ahead.
Now, if there's one thing President Obama can take comfort in, it's this fact. At the same point in his presidency, Jimmy Carter was far more popular than President Obama is today. But according to Robert Dalek, there's a better parallel.
One can think back to 1982. Ronald Reagan, 52% of the public said they didn't want to see him run again for president.
Which is about the same as what people are saying about President Obama now.
Exactly. The economy was in very poor shape. People said, well, Reagan's too old to run again. But the real issue was the economy. 2 years later, when he ran again for president, the economy had made a huge comeback. And he won a landslide. He won a massive re-election. Same could happen with President Obama.
When you compare President Obama to his predecessors, is he doing anything wrong when it comes to trying to tell his narrative and the story of what his administration has been able to do?
I don't know that he's doing anything wrong. Maybe he could do more of what he's doing. Maybe he needs to get out there and be more on the hustings with a shriller voice than the one he's demonstrating.
I mean, who did that work for?
Well, it certainly worked for Franklin Roosevelt. In 1934, his congressional vote was one of the two in the 20th century that showed an increase for his party, and negative feelings about the Republicans were so substantial. And Roosevelt had made progress. He hadn't cured the depression by any means, but there was a sense of movement in the right direction.
Robert Talek, I'm interested in the analogy you draw between President Roosevelt and President Obama. Of course, there were many of these analogies made when President Obama came into office because he inherited the worst economy since the Great Depression. What could President Obama learn from President Roosevelt's approach back then that worked?
Well, I think what he could learn is that Roosevelt was an experimenter. His New Deal was like the quarterback on a football team. You try one play, it doesn't work, you move on to something else. This is what perhaps President Obama needs to invoke, is the idea that we've done a certain amount, we've made certain gains, we've prevented things from being worse, but now we're going to do more. And he needs to be more innovative. That might be the lesson he should take from Franklin Roosevelt.
That's historian Robert Talek. His new book comes out next month. It's called The Lost Peace, Leadership in a Time of Horror and Hope. Robert Talek, thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
The Strand Bookstore in New York is legendary. It claims to hold 18 miles of books. And that's where Anesi Liddell found herself a few weeks ago, just browsing.
I just wanted a book to read on the subway. I really don't read that much, I guess, but I mean, it's the summer and, you know, 30 Rock's not on anymore, so I need something to do.
She picked up a copy of Don DeLillo's classic, White Noise, but when she opened it up, she saw something scrawled on the inside cover. A name. The name of the previous owner. And the name was David Markson.
The girls at the counter said, oh, this is one of Markson's. We have his whole collection. I have no idea who they're talking about. But then when I was reading it, I noticed, like, first you put a lot of check marks by some passages, and then you put no, and then the comments just got meaner and meaner. So then I looked them up and realized that he had just died.
It turned out David Markson hadn't just been a casual reader. He was a writer himself and well-known in literary circles. David Foster Wallace even called Markson's novel Wittgenstein's Mistress pretty much the high point of experimental fiction. And now Anesi had a book from Markson's personal library in her possession.
Thought it was worth putting on my Facebook, so I did that.
After word spread of Anesi's find, other people started trolling the shelves of the Strand, also hoping to find annotated books from Markson's personal collection. Which raised the question, how did his library wind up there?
Because he wanted it to.
That's Craig Furman. He wrote about Markson's lost library for the Boston Globe this week.
Markson actually had a long and personal relationship with the Strand. Employees knew him by name. He would go several times a week and they would have conversations.
Markson died this past June, and his family handed over 63 boxes of his personal library to the Strand.
And the Strand ended up sending a truck to pick up the books. From there, they sorted it out. These go to the philosophy section. These go to art history. Novels, literary criticism and philosophy, a lot of books of classical literature, T.S. Eliot's letters and essays, books on Wittgenstein's philosophy. Then the books were sorted and just sent out on the Strand's normal shelves.
Now, not all of Markson's books had his writing in them, but Anesi Liddell's copy of White Noise was furiously annotated.
He would put check marks by certain passages, underline passages that seemed to speak to him, but he would also kind of disagree and quibble with people. So somebody like DeLillo, in the margins, he would write, ugh, or no, or get to the point.
He would be having a conversation with Don DeLillo in the margins of DeLillo's book.
Right. And it wasn't the most pleasant conversation. I think my favorite comment was, this book might have set the all-time record for boredom.
Craig Furman is a graduate student in English at Yale. He says you can learn a lot about authors, what may have influenced their work, by studying their personal libraries. But unfortunately, very few of those collections have ever been preserved.
Twain is an especially cringeworthy case study, I think, because even though Twain was always Mark Twain the way we think of him today, his books were not well cared for, and they ended up scattered everywhere. He actually started donating some of his own books off, and you would think once they were in the library, they might be more safe, but unfortunately, that wasn't the case. The library circulated them with all their other books, so you would have souvenir hunters kind of swoop in, cut out pages where Twain's handwriting, his notes, or him signing the flyleaf of the book. Twain just didn't really see these books as that important. He had the books that he had written, and that's what mattered to him.
Herman Melville's collection was also famously scattered. After his death, his family saved just a few books, and even then, only the smallest ones. They were short on space.
His will noted that he owned at least 1,000 books, but scholars have been able to deduce only about 400 titles. The ones that survive are certainly interesting. He owned a copy of John Milton's poems, actually. From that, you can tell things like he read Paradise Lost while he was writing Moby Dick. Certainly an important and fascinating connection to think about those two works side by side.
That copy of John Milton's poems, by the way, was auctioned back in the 1980s for $100,000. So why wasn't the entire collection preserved, or for that matter, those of other famous writers?
As a culture, we just kind of fixate on this idea of a writer who's alone and doing his work. So things like manuscripts and diaries and journals, and those get saved, those get preserved and cared for. But when it comes to a writer's books, they don't receive the same kind of care and attention just because they're less immediately connectable to the author's personality.
And what about Anna C. Liddell, the one who got hold of David Markson's personal copy of the Don DeLillo novel White Noise? Well, it turns out she never finished the book at all. Instead, she decided to read David Markson's novels, but she's keeping her tattered copy of White Noise nonetheless.
There's one guy that asked me if he could buy my book, but I politely declined. I mean, things like this don't happen to me. Like, I found this thing, I want to hold on to it. It's my talisman. I feel like it's going to help me someday.
When Ingrid Betancourt walked into our studios this past week, the first thing that struck me was her size. She is very small, soft-spoken, and almost fragile. And yet for 6 years, she managed to withstand torture, deprivation, and isolation as a prisoner of the Colombian terrorist group, the FARC. The story began in 2002 when Betancourt was running for president of Colombia. She was traveling to a remote village to campaign when she was stopped by a group of armed men. She'd been warned the area was controlled by the FARC, but figured she'd be safe. She was wrong. Betancourt was taken prisoner and brought deep into a makeshift prison camp inside the Amazon jungle. Her captors treated her and the other prisoners like animals.
The meal arrived as I got back to the cage. Flour, water, and sugar. That evening, I huddled in my corner. During the hours of that night without sleep, and during the days that followed, my entire being undertook a curious path that led to the hibernation of my body and soul, waiting for freedom, like the coming of spring.
That's Ingrid Betancourt reading from her new book about her time in captivity. It's called Even Silence Has an End. And this is her story.
At the beginning, I thought it was going to be for a couple of weeks. Then I thought perhaps a couple of months, because then I realized it was just lingering. And I said, okay, perhaps till the end of the presidential campaign. And then when a year went on and I thought, my God, this is a year now. So it's going to be long. And it lasted for 6.5 years.
You were initially brought deep into the jungle, and you were moved around during your time. But you were in one main prison camp for much of that time. Can you describe what it was like?
Okay. We were 10 hostages confined in a very small space, surrounded with barbed wire. And we had to live with people we didn't know, men and women all together. We had to share a little space where we were allowed to do our, you know, bathing, and it was like the toilet spot. And that space was one of the problems we had, because we were too many people for a too small space, and it triggered all kind of confrontation. I think that the FARC was trying to break the unity of the group. It was one of their targets because they were afraid we could rebel. So the life there was not only difficult because of the space, because of the lack of food, because of the lack of information, but also because we were forced to share that space in a situation that was hard for everyone.
And surrounded by what you describe as this vastness, the vast jungle. I mean, it was relatively easy to escape, and you actually tried to escape 5 times. The problem, you write, was what then?
How it was very difficult to escape. I mean, we were surrounded by guards. we did it sometimes, and we succeeded to just go out to that jungle. And we discovered that the jungle was another prison. Hmm. Over that ring of security they had, it was impossible to get out.
After your, I believe it was your fifth and final attempt, when you were unsuccessful, you were beaten, you were chained. What happened to you?
It was a moment of agony, because I was chained to a tree by the neck 24 hours a day. I was forbidden to talk to my fellow hostages. I was in a position where everything was denied to me. I mean, everything. If I wanted to drink some water, I had to ask permission. And when it was raining, they could put me out, and I was under the pouring rain and with no shelter. And if I want to go pee, I had to ask permission. And sometimes they would deny the permission, or they would just tell me to relieve myself in front of everybody. So it was very humiliating. It was very hard.
I'm speaking with Ingrid Betancourt. For 6 years, she was held prisoner by the Colombian paramilitary group FARC. Her memoir of that time is called Even Silence Has an End. You were taken prisoner with your then campaign manager, Clara Rojas, over the 6 year period living in such sort of confined spaces. Your relationship became estranged. She and many of the other prisoners learned to adapt. They learned to answer to numbers rather than their names. You refused. You refused to answer to a number and really refused to adapt. Why? Why didn't you just, you know, sort of say, I'm going to go with this in the hopes that maybe they'll release us all?
I had a problem. I had this belief that I couldn't just accept to be treated as an object. It was a problem of dignity. And it wasn't understood by my fellow hostages. Sometimes they thought this was arrogant or I was a troublemaker, but it wasn't that. It was just that I couldn't accept that they would call us by number, because I thought it would make them easier to kill us if they had to kill an object, a number. I didn't want to make it easier for them. My duty was to regain my freedom, because I had children waiting for me. So I was obsessed with escaping. And I knew that because we had become a sort of trophy for the FARC, they were not going to just negotiate us or to free us.
I mean, you were at a time the most famous prisoner in the world. The French government was trying to win your release, and there were others around the world who were trying to win your release. You knew of this. You had access, occasional access, to radio reports. And you write about how that caused some tension with your fellow prisoners, because you were the sort of the face of the prisoners.
Yes. At the beginning, I didn't understand why they were reacting to me with such an aggressive, you know, attitude. But my fellow hostages, like me, we were in a very deprived situation where everything was being denied from us. And the only thing we could cling to was our name, to just prove our existence. And because the only name that was brought up every time was mine, they were resenting that it was like the only one that existed was me.
I can't imagine what it would be like to be a prisoner for a week, let alone 6 years. How did you just get through the day? I mean, at a certain point, you must have thought, I'm going to be here forever.
Yeah, I thought that. The relationship with time changes when you're captive. In the free world, your days pass very quickly because you have so many things to do and you're in control of your life. In our case, when we were abducted, it was exactly the opposite. The days were eternal. Mm. We didn't know how to just fill those days with things, because we were always into two extremes, boredom and the anxiety of what could happen. And then those days that were so long, when we look back at the years piling up behind us in so quick, I remember the day I just thought, oh my God, 6 years have passed by. And it had happened so quick.
You write about at times you had a Harry Potter book between you, and then at one time you had a dictionary that you carried with you. I mean, not much there to do.
And the Bible.
And the Bible.
And the Bible, which was for me incredible. Because when I was freed, I just, you know, sometimes I opened the Bible to read a passage, and I really thought it was a boring kind of reading, you know. But I think because it was, I was so bored in the jungle. I had those endless days. I managed to read the Bible from the first page to the end. And I really think my relationship to God changed so dramatically in the jungle. I had to answer questions honestly, you know, like, do I believe that he was resurrected and that he really, I mean, is that possible? Hmm. So my answer, and I'll spare you all the reasoning, was it came to a point where it could not be true.
Ingrid Betancourt, obviously the United States and the European Union regard the FARC as a terrorist organization. You came to the conclusion pretty rapidly that the FARC is simply an armed wing for the drug trade.
I think it's a cartel. It's a drug cartel. Very well organized, armed, everything, but it's a drug cartel. And this is something that for me was a discovery, because I am of a generation where we like Che Guevara, you know, the very romantic
kind of
revolution thing.
Yeah.
And in a way, I thought that the FARC was kind of a romantic rebellion against a system that I didn't like either. But when I was inside, I just discovered it was as corrupt as the system. It wasn't a response to the problems we had in Colombia.
Ingrid Betancourt, I have to ask you about some of the controversy about your book. Obviously, other former prisoners have written or expressed their own accounts and have written about friction between them and you. Clara Rojas, your former campaign manager, who was a close friend, has angrily denied some of your account of the book, particularly her pregnancy. She became pregnant in captivity and had that child. Is it painful for you to hear the criticism from your former fellow prisoner?
Well, everyone is entitled to say what they want to say. And in Clara's specific case, I respect a lot her decision. And for me, I just look at it in the perspective of what we were. We were victims of the FARC. We didn't choose to be together and to live what we had to live. We were not the perfect people in the standards of heroes. I wish we had been. But I truly think we were the best we could.
I'm speaking with Ingrid Betancourt. For 6 years, she was held prisoner by the Colombian paramilitary group FARC. Her memoir of that time is called Even Silence Has an End. Ingrid Betancourt, there were moments, strangely enough, bizarre moments of joy, as you describe, in this six-year period. 1 year for your daughter's, Melanie's 17th birthday, some of the guerrillas brought out a cake.
Yeah.
How did you react to that?
Well, I was very thankful. Because you see, sometimes in the worst situations and with the people, the most cruel and cold-hearted people, sometimes you have a space for humanity. You see, there was this girl who was close to the commander. And when I had the chance, I talked to her and I said, look, it's my daughter's birthday and I want to make something out of that day. I don't want just to pass it like another day. Could you help me? I would like to bake a cake. When I say bake, you know, I mean,
there were no ovens there.
No, there was nothing. But it was kind of a fried dough, but it was something. And I thought I wouldn't have any response. But what happened there, I don't know. The commander wanted to please her, or they just thought they wanted to have something that I could remember as as a good gesture about them. For me, I just reduce it to those parentheses of good, even dealing with the bad, you know.
You were obviously rescued in 2008. One day, a helicopter lands with what seem to be FARC paramilitaries. They tell all the hostages to get on the helicopter. They say you're going to be moved to another camp. You're all brought to the helicopter. Takes off, and within a few minutes, you're told you're free. We're the Colombian National Army. Did you believe them?
Oh, yes. Yes, of course I believe them. I mean, we were in this helicopter, and the helicopter began to fly up, and I saw the two commanders of the guerrilla that had been our commanders for years. They were lying on the floor, beaten up, handcuffed. And I didn't understand what was going on until the moment there was this huge scream, "We are the Colombian Army, you are free." Wow. And at that moment, just time freeze, because you have been for so many years just confronted to your horrible fate that you cannot believe that this is happening to you, you see? So it took a while for me to just react.
Were people crying? Were people hugging? I mean,
well, I remember that I screamed. And it was a scream like a beast scream. And I'm not sure if the scream was of joy or of fear. Because in a moment, I remember looking at the eyes of William, one of my companions. He was sitting beside me. And we were so frightened. Because this was like the end of that life and the beginning of a new one. And what was that new one coming? It was like when you're confronted to the void, you know, you have this impression of you're going to die there because you're going to fall and you don't know where. And everybody was shouting, jumping, and I thought we're going to crash. The helicopter is going to crash. We're not going to be free.
It's the end of the movie.
End of the movie. The horrible ending. We're going to crash. And we didn't. We landed like a rose on that tarmac in a village in the jungle of Colombia. And when the door opened, that's when I realized the dream had come true.
I read that you decided within the last 2 years that for the rest of your life, you're going to wear perfume every day.
Yes.
And that you're not going to deprive yourself of eating cake. Anything else that you promised yourself?
Yes, I promised to have ice cream in my diet. And I promised to change my priorities. You see, I think that the whole concept of happiness changed for me. When I was in the jungle, I read, and it comes many times in the Bible, it says that when you cross the Valley of Tears and you arrive to the oasis, the reward of God is not success, it's not money, it's not admiration or fame, it's not power. His reward is rest. So that's what I want for me now, rest.
Ingrid Betancourt, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
That's Ingrid Betancourt. Her memoir of her time as a prisoner of the Colombian rebel group FARC is called Even Silence Has an End.
I'm your governor, Pete Wilson, you know, the baddest governor to ever grab a mic and go boom, give me a punch and watch me hack it.
This is how a lot of music fans got to know Michael Franti in the early 1990s. He was the frontman for the hip-hop band Disposable Heroes of Hip-Hopercy. The Disposable Heroes were political and sometimes angry and the furthest thing from being hitmakers. But then, in 2009, Michael Franti did, in fact, score a hit, a song called Say Hey that reached the Billboard Top 20. Now, while his sound may have changed, his message hasn't. Michael Franti's new album may be called The Sound of Sunshine, but it still deals with issues that he's been passionate about: social justice, the environment, Middle East peace.
So tell me why did the birds that used to fly here? Tell me why do they come to die here? And all the kids that used to run here? Tell me why did they load their guns here?
And Michael Franti joins me from our studios at NPR West in Southern California. Welcome, great to have you.
Thanks, it's great to be here, guy.
What do you think of that Michael Franti we heard, that Michael Franti from 1992, the Disposable Hero, Michael Franti? Do you think you're a completely different artist?
Well, I think that my soul is intact, but my methods of reaching people is completely different. When I first started out, I thought it was enough just to make an angry song that pointed out the problems of the world. And then when I got out into the world and started seeing how my music was affecting people and meeting people who were directly faced with those problems, like, for example, playing in a prison, I'd go in there and sing an angry song about how messed up the prison system is. And they'd say, man, we want to hear songs about how much we miss our girlfriend. It really made me rethink the importance of happy music.
You've traveled all around the world as a musician, but you also spent some time in Iraq, in the Gaza Strip, in the West Bank, and in Israel. Talk about why you went there.
Well, I went there because I got tired of watching the news and feeling like I wasn't hearing the whole story about what was happening in Iraq. I'd hear these explanations by generals and politicians and nothing from the soldiers or from people who just lived on the street. And so I took my guitar and a video camera and six of my friends and flew on a little 16-passenger plane from Amman, Jordan to Baghdad, and I'd play music on the street for people there. And they would listen and then take me into their homes and their hospitals, their mosques, their schools, and tell me about their lives. And I made a film about it called I Know I'm Not Alone. And at nighttime, I'd spend with off-duty U.S. soldiers who were in their bars. And, you know, I'd kind of walk into a bar with my wooden guitar, and these guys would all be in there polishing their M16s and have a beer in one hand and a rifle in the other hand. And they'd kind of be looking at me like, couldn't they have sent, you know, Jessica Simpson here or something to entertain us, you know. I would sing this song called Bomb the World, and the lyrics say, we can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. And suddenly these soldiers would look up and they'd come to me and they'd go, you know, it takes some big, you know, cojones to walk in here and sing a song like that.
You say you're sorry, Lord. There is no other choice. God bless the people, and no, who cannot raise their voice. We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world into pieces, but can we bomb the world to peace?
I'm talking to Michael Fronte. He's the frontman with the band Spearhead. Their new record is called The Sound of Sunshine. And it was written and recorded after a pretty serious health scare. You thought you were going to die.
Yeah, I was on tour with the Counting Crows, and we were opening for them. And I had all this abdominal pain, and I kept going to many doctors over a long period of time, and no one could figure out what it was. And finally, I felt this pop in my abdomen, and my appendix had ruptured. And it was still 7 days after that before they did a CAT scan and figured out what it was. But by this point, my belly had become very distended. I looked like I was 4 months pregnant.
And wow.
My girlfriend assured me that I wasn't. But I was...
You were in pain, presumably.
Oh, incredible pain. And each day that went by that they couldn't figure out what it was, you know, I kept going deeper into, well, it's not my appendix, it's not my gallbladder, oh, now I have cancer. And I was building up all these things in my head. And so by the time I got the diagnosis and the surgery, I felt such incredible relief that I was still alive. And the simplest things, like eating an orange, they just really stuck out to me. And so I wrote all these new songs about simple things like that.
So there's this idea that you have this sort of near-death experience, and almost all the songs you write are actually happy and joyful out of it.
Yeah, because every day in the hospital, I'd go over to the window and I'd pull back the curtain to see if the sun was shining. And if it was, I'd get this feeling like, yes, I'm going to be better today. I'm still here. I'd touch myself and say, I'm still alive, you know. And I wanted to bottle that feeling for people because right now is a really difficult time in our country and in the world. And I wanted to make a record that people could put on and it would lift them up the way that the sun would do that for me each day.
I wake up in the morning at 6 o'clock. They say there may be rain, but the sun is hot. I wish I had some time just to kill today. And I wish
Earlier we heard California Uber Alice that you recorded in 1992. It's about the then-Governor Pete Wilson of California and some of his policies that you disagreed with. And obviously, you know, somebody like you with a really devoted fan base, hardcore fan base, is bound to get some criticism from some of those fans. You might say, hey, you know, where's that Michael Franti, the one who was writing these sort of impassioned lyrics? Where is he? What do you say to them?
Well, the first thing I say is that there was a time when I wrote songs about things, but really was not involved in the issues as directly as I am today. So I just look at it like it's a kind of a 2.0 thing. You know, activism has changed. I remember in the first Gulf War, there was protests in San Francisco, right. And there was a group of people who went out onto the Bay Bridge. And on the news, it was covered as war protesters shut down the Bay Bridge. And then in the next Gulf War, people went out on the bridge and shut down, and it didn't make the news. It just made the traffic report. There's some crazy people on the bridge, you know. And so you have to find new ways that fit with the technology that you have available and that fit within the social noise. You have to find ways to get through.
You once sang, if ever I could stop thinking about music and politics, I guess you can't.
Not with people like you asking me all the time, guy.
That's Michael Franti. He's a frontman for the band Spearhead. The new record is called The Sound of Sunshine. If you'd like to hear a few tracks, they're at our website, nprmusic.org. Michael Franti, thank you so much.
Thank you, guy.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always find the entire uncut program at our website, npr.org. Do you believe me? Do you believe me when I say